Good afternoon. Welcome to the 484th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we're pleased to have Dr. Sherry Goodman here to speak on Arctic security in a changing environment. Sherry Goodman is a pioneer in sustainability and national security. She is among the most respected international voices on the emerging global risks, including energy and climate security, environment, and public health. As the Pentagon's first ever Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security, she led efforts to transform the Department of Defense into a leader in sustainability, climate resilience, and advanced energy. Today, Ms. Goodman serves as Secretary General of the International Military Council on Climate and Security. Until recent, she was with the Wilson Center, which unfortunately has been pretty much disbanded by the current administration. Her book, Threat Multiplier, Climate Change, the Military, and Fight for Global Security, gives readers an inside account from the Pentagon to the battlefield of today's military on the front lines of a changing climate, the energy transition, technology upheavals, and new health challenges. A summa cum laude graduate of Amherst College, she earned a law degree from Harvard Law School and a master's degree in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. She received an honorary doctorate in humane letters from Amherst College in 2018 and a lifetime achievement award from the Environmental Peacebuilding Association in The Hague just last year. Sherry, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Well, good afternoon, all. It's really a privilege and a pleasure to be number 484. Yeah, okay. A special shout out to George and Karen for organizing this, and to Courtney, who really did a lot of the legwork. So thank you to all of you, all the team that put this together. I know it doesn't happen by itself. And it's really a great privilege for me to be here in Maine. I have deep affection and connection with this state. I did a bike trip here when I was a teenager from Sebago Lake to Bar Harbor. And the state's culture and feeling is deeply embedded in me. My daughter went to Colby College, and so I've had many opportunities to come to this beautiful and lovely state. So it's wonderful to be here with you all, and I'm going to tell you the story of Threat Multiplier and with a particular focus on Arctic climate and security, and through the lens of my book. But I'm going to start with a story, because we have a very special guest here, my longtime friend, mentor, and advisor, Walt Slocum. And I have to tell this story because Walt and Ellen, particularly Walt, really helped get me started in this field. And I know we have at least a few young people here. Okay, not too many, but there are a few. So I want to say how much it really matters, and many of you have done this in your careers for other people. But the story, my story with Walt Slocum is I met him when I was a college student. I was taking a year at the London School of Economics, and I was looking for a topic on which to write my senior thesis. And Walt, then serving at the Pentagon, was in London for a conference. And I asked him, I said, do you have any ideas for me about what I could write about? And he said, oh yeah, how about the neutron bomb controversy? Okay, all right, what's that? I was studying like nuclear weapons and national security during the Cold War. And through Walt's good offices and his help, I ended up doing many first-person interviews with people in the Pentagon, State Department on the Hill. I wrote my senior thesis on the neutron bomb, a case study in alliance politics. I won't give you the whole story on that now, but that became my first book, published a few years after I graduated from college. And in the course of meeting Walt and many others, I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a senior official in the Pentagon someday. And you know what? Thanks to Walt and many others, it actually happened for me. So I say that story both first to thank you, Walt, because you've been so important in my career, and also to say that for young people, look for those people who can be not only your mentors, but your sponsors and help you, and to thank all of you who've already done that for many others in your own life. So, okay, on to this story that we're going to talk about today, and I'm going to give you a snapshot through this overview of the, in my experience, the convergence of climate change and national security over the last several decades. And we've, through the Cold War, when I got started in this field, really focused on hard security, nuclear weapons, arms control, then through the end of the Cold War, fall of the Berlin Wall, and then on into the age of terror, 9/11, and now into the COVID and the era beyond, we have seen also the rise of environmental and climate practices, regulations, focus, to the point that they now, in my view, have really converged. So the climate and environment is really part of how we think about our national security today. Now, to go back a little bit and tell you a little of my backstory, after I wrote this book on nuclear weapons and worked with a defense contractor and left Harvard Law and Harvard Kennedy School, I worked on the Senate Armed Services Committee for Senator Nunn, who was chairman of the committee at the time, very powerful chairman in the 1980s. And my job was to oversee the nation's nuclear weapons complex budget for the committee, as the principal staff person. And that at that time, we had weapons reactors around the country, mostly in Hanford, Savannah River, not much here in the Northeast, but in many other parts of the country, weapons reactors and processing facilities where we made fissile materials, plutonium, tritium, uranium for nuclear bombs. And during the course of the 1980s, all these reactors and processing facilities failed for environment safety and health lapses. And because at the end of the Cold War, we didn't need as much plutonium, as Secretary of Energy said, we're awash in plutonium. So I say my career went from weapons to waste. And from overseeing these active facilities, producing facilities, we were then overseeing the creation of the first environmental management and environmental cleanup programs that to this day is still the major, one of the major budget functions of the Department of Energy in places like Hanford, Savannah River, Oak Ridge. And so that is a, and that sort of shifted my career then into the field of environmental security. And in the 1990s, starting in 1993, I served, Walt was in the Pentagon, I was the first Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security. What does that mean? I was like the Chief Environmental and Sustainability Officer for the Pentagon. I had to wrangle folks in the military to try to agree with the policies and the directions of our president, President Clinton, and Vice President Al Gore, who was really the environmental conscience of the administration, and also get Congress to agree with the directions in which we were going. So it's up, down, in and out in terms of management. And that's, in this era, we were closing a lot of military bases. Some of you may remember Naval Air Station Brunswick, or we had many more military installations in the East Coast that closed, Devens, Pease Air Force Base, a number of them. And so we were focused on closing bases and then cleaning them up. And that was sort of how environment, sort of getting that right was part of internalizing understanding of environmental stewardship in the for the military in that time. Now, it was not only about pollution, cleaning up pollution in the past, but it was also about conserving natural resources and endangered species, many of which make their home on military bases around the country, because the military is the nation's second largest landholder. And so there are endangered species and fragile ecosystems. And the red-cockaded woodpecker lives in the longleaf pine tree that is found on Camp Lejeune and Fort Bragg, Eglin Air Force Base, and many other military bases across the southeastern United States. And most of the healthy stands of longleaf pine left today that harbor the endangered red cockaded woodpecker are today on military bases because other areas have been developed. And so there was a special responsibility, and Fort Bragg, the Army's major training areas, home of the 82nd Airborne, had training shut down for a time for failure to protect the nest of the red-cockaded woodpecker. So what's a general to do? Well, I had the privilege of working with some very great generals and leaders at the time, General Sullivan, who was Chief of Staff of the Army, General Krulak, Commandant of the Marine Corps, and their teams determined that, well, instead of cutting down the tree, which is what they had been doing, which lost the nest for the woodpecker, they could instead leave the tree in place and turn it into a realistic training obstacle. And that way, they could enhance training and they could protect the nest of the bird. So, in fact, during this era, the Marines ran a campaign called Saving a Few Good Species. And, okay, so that was about understanding how you can both train and be ready, because readiness is all important for our military forces, and at the same time address environmental stewardship. Now, I know you're particularly interested in the Arctic here, and my first Arctic encounters occurred during the 1990s when the Secretary of Defense at the time, it was Bill Perry, Walt and I were working for Bill Perry, and he walked down to my office one day, which is something the Secretary of Defense never, I always went to his office, I waited, I was fortunate to get to meet with him. Okay, but one day he just walks down the hall, because he liked the wine, he goes into my office, and he says, Sherry, I just met with the Norwegian Minister of Defense, and he says the most important thing in U.S.-Norwegian defense relations, this is 1994, is that the U.S. military engaged the Russian military about waste streams leaking from sunken and decommissioned Russian submarines in the Kola Peninsula. And he said, okay, that's the problem, you go fix it. And he left. No, he didn't. But, I mean, he said, okay, you figure out how we're going to engage the Russian military with the Norwegians to come up with some solutions. So we did. That became what the program called Arctic Military Environmental Cooperation. And through this program, it was in many ways a form of soft power. I know that's going to be your next series, because it was about working and exchanging information, environmental information and education with the Russian and Norwegian military. I spoke at many Russian military academies. We brought them to the U.S. We brought them to Alaska. I spent a lot of time in Russia, although I always had my designated drinker. After my first time in Russia, and I had to crawl out from under the table after the evening, after all the toasts, because everybody had to make a toast, and as head of the delegation, you had to make a lot of toasts. Okay, but there was always an American military officer. In those days, they were all men. Today, not so much, but and they would say, oh yeah, I can drink with the Russians. Okay, maybe they couldn't, but they had to pay the price, not me. And also, I was having babies in that era, so okay, when I was pregnant, I always got a pass. We had about a decade of cooperation with the Russian military, through which we built a cask, a white cask, that enabled the liquid waste streams from the leaking Russian submarines in the Kola Peninsula to be offloaded and then containerized and shipped by rail inland for safer storage. That was one of our flagship solutions. And it was a companion program to one that Walt at the time was very much involved in called Cooperative Threat Reduction, which was actually removing the new weapon systems and the fissile materials from Russia and former Russian states. So that era, unfortunately, has gone, but we're going to come back to that in a moment. So now on into the aughts, the 2000s. And after my almost decade of experience at the Department of Defense, I landed at the Center for Naval Analysis, which, like RAND, some of you may know, these are defense-sponsored research and analysis organizations think tanks for pointy heads and serious people that do hard analysis for defense and sponsors and the intelligence community. And it was there that I convened the first group of generals and admirals to assess the national security implications of climate change. Now, we had known about climate impacts to a certain extent going back into the 90s when in the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, 1998, the U.S. had a position that was actually at the time we wanted to exempt military operational activities from any limits on greenhouse gas emissions because we didn't want to be subject to any limitations on the ability to deploy our forces for an operational mission anywhere around the world. Those measurements have changed dramatically, and now we look at it in a different way. But at that time, we didn't really think about the security implication. What happens when the planet warms, and how does that affect our security? Well, the generals and admirals and I, we spent a year with leading climate scientists around the world, in the U.S., in the U.K., and elsewhere, and with intelligence and national security analysts and others. And at the end of that year, we released a report called Climate Change and National Security and the Threat of Climate Change. And we characterized it then as a threat multiplier. That was the term I coined to sort of encapsulate and convey and communicate what does climate change do that to increase the threats and risks we face around the world. And that really has begun several decades of focus on what I call the climate threat multipliers, you might call them climate perils. You know that heat is rising dramatically, temperatures are rising around the world. Every day you look at your weather app and you say, oh, it's really nice today here in Maine. And you look down further, you scroll down and you say, oh yeah, it's like 10 degrees above the normal average, you know, almost every day now, most places. Okay, drought, we have prolonged drought around the world. And wildfires, of course, we know the LA fires in Greece, in Spain, everywhere. Sea level rise, flooding, of course, the deadly floods, tragic in Texas just recently, much more intensification and deadly storms of different types, as well as permafrost thaw and collapse. And that has led to a great increase in extreme weather events around the world and in the U.S. As you can see, just in the last two decades, we've had extreme heat has increased significantly, and ocean heat and societal damages and many other ways in which we look at storms, fires, droughts, rain and flooding, cold snow and ice. Okay, now let's travel up to the Arctic. And here we are in Maine, and I know Senator King likes to call Maine the East Coast Arctic State. So I don't know if you can find Maine right from this view of the map, but when you look down, you can see you get a different view of the world when you look at it from the polar regions. And just to orient you, you know, there are eight Arctic coastal states, of which U.S., Canada, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, and Denmark via Greenland, and of course Russia, which has the longest Arctic coastline of any nation. Okay, and the Arctic is warming four times, in some places seven times. Somebody asked me about that yesterday, so there it is, than the rest of the planet. And the Arctic acts as a planetary cooling system and a global climate stabilizer. So it has been losing ice, 13% ice mass per decade. So you can see the dramatic changes that are occurring. And the Arctic, in many ways, is really a global early warning system. We often say what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It will lead to, the changes in the Arctic are leading to more frequent droughts in the Amazon rainforest, reduction in Arctic sea ice, changes in Atlantic circulation, slowing down since the 1950s, that can affect the jet stream, the Gulf Stream. Changes in boreal forests, changes to coral reefs we see around the world, large-scale coral dives. Any of you who are divers know how tragic it is, what's happened in Australia in the Great Barrier Reef. The Great Greenland Ice Sheet, the ice loss is accelerating dramatically. I had a chance to actually see that last summer. Permafrost thawing and melting. West Antarctic Ice Sheet is also thawing and melting. Okay, so now, how does our military forces experience that? Well, as a story, Admiral Fogo was a submariner. He retired as a four-star former head of U.S. forces in Europe. And as a young submariner, he went up to the Arctic, and he took his submarine, and they did a maneuver called ice pick, where they pop out up on the ice, and the sailors can get out and put on a Santa cap and maybe play a little baseball, take a few pictures, send it home to their families because they've been, you know, stuck below for many months. He said, maybe golf balls, but he said, don't use white because you can't find them. So use yellow, okay? So he did that back in 1981 as a young submariner, and then he went back about 20 years later, and now he's in command of the submarine, different submarine. And he goes back and he tries to do this same maneuver in approximately the same place near the North Pole, and there's not enough ice anymore to do that. And when he actually surfaces, he finds blue water and plastic waste. So that is his experience on the front lines of a changing Arctic. And there are increased navigation routes through the region. There is the Northern Sea Route, which hugs the shallow Russian coastline that stretches from the Pacific all the way across into western Russia. And under Putin, he envisions that as a toll road for transportation from ports in Asia to ports in Europe. The Northwest Passage in the Canadian Arctic has seen more tourism, more development. It's much shallower, harder to navigate, not as clear a future commercial shipping. And in the Central Arctic, an area that is not yet primarily navigable and is protected through a fishing moratorium, Central Arctic fishing moratorium, which the U.S. and a number of other nations, including China, Russia, and many others, have signed, and it expires in about another decade or so. And it gives all the parties, including China and others, opportunities to do research and observation in the region. And there are many times I think that the ultimate prize in the Central Arctic will in the future be the fish. Fish, as fish stocks move northward with warming waters. They are now very productive in the near polar regions around today between Norway and Russia, and in the Southern Ocean in Antarctica as well. Now, China has significant Arctic ambitions of its own. It issued its first Arctic policy in 2018, and it declared itself, China, to be a near Arctic stakeholder and a near Arctic power, and envisions this polar silk road where it engages today with Russia to it's invested in helping build out energy projects along the Arctic at Yamal and other places. It's developed its own icebreaking capability. In fact, today China has more icebreakers than the United States. And it has declared that a future Central Arctic route will provide shorter shipping times by as much as 3 weeks over today's traditional routes through the Straits of Hormuz and the Malacca Straits. So you can see a future. China is very focused on, of course, strategic planning. This is not going to happen necessarily in the next decade, but they are looking to the future. Okay. In Russia, one of the big issues there is that there actually are, unlike in most other Arctic nations, the U.S., there are actually very significant industrial capabilities. Russia, during the Cold War, built out a lot of plants, infrastructure, military infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, economic infrastructure, and much of it's on permafrost, and a lot of that is thawing and collapsing today. That releases additional methane when the permafrost melts, and that is a challenge because most of the methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas than even carbon dioxide, the methane releases from permafrost are by and large not captured in today's global climate models. They focus on methane from oil and gas operations, and there had been, when there was a big push on climate, there was a focus on reducing methane from oil and gas. But methane from permafrost is a growing challenge in the Arctic. Okay, and I want to say a little bit about Greenland, because of course it's been much in the news, and we could have the whole talk about Greenland, and I'm happy to take questions about it. So Greenland, as you can see, you know, Greenland is really part of the North American continent. It had until recently been, in terms of our military areas of operations, aligned with EUCOM, European Command, because it is an independent territory of Denmark, increasingly with its own self-determination. And within the last month or two, the U.S. realigned Greenland under Northern Command, better to manage a sort of homeland view of missile and space defense and other increasing navigation in the region. Now, Greenland it was very interesting to be in Greenland last summer. You really feel like you're on the front lines of a changing world. The ice cap is melting at a very rapid rate. And you now see, as a result, there are many more icebergs in the fjords now, and coastal navigation, which is how you get around. There are very few roads, 57,000 people. They live in settlements. I was in the third largest settlement of Ilulissat, and that population is 5,000 people. Okay. So there are very few roads. People travel by boat and aircraft and helicopter. And in the winter, by dog sled and snowmobile. And so increasingly you have, from the fjords, you have more icebergs being released. You see a changing climate, changing economy. Greenlanders themselves have recently had an election. They are becoming increasingly independent from Denmark, but they still rely on a lot of investment from the Danes, who have invested billions of dollars both in their defense and their economy. Two upgraded airports opened in the last year in Greenland, including one that now allows for the first nonstop flights from the US to Greenland, started just this summer from New York to Nuuk. And it's a very short flight. Any of you who's been to Iceland, right? A lot of you probably been to Iceland, right? So it's so easy to get from Boston to Iceland. It's like less than 5 hours. Well, it's less than 4 hours from New York to Nuuk. So really you see how close you are. And so and Greenland has said, we are open for business, but we're not open for sale. Okay. Okay. All right. I'm going to really race through the couple of more discussions about how climate is affecting us elsewhere around the world. General Tom Mittendorp is my co-partner, former Dutch Chief of Defense in the International Military Council on Climate and Security, deployed many times in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, and experienced how increasing water scarcity and water severity makes it very hard to recover and have stability in places that are racked by conflict already. In the Pacific, Admiral Locklear, former head of U.S. Pacific Command, has said that climate is the greatest long-term threat to the region, as he faced increased deadly typhoons and deployed forces to rescue those at risk throughout the region. And elsewhere in the vast Pacific, you have whole island country nations like Kiribati that have already made plans to relocate parts of their population to other nations, because some of the atolls will soon lose fresh water from sea level rise and salinity. And you have growing climate migration and displacement around the world, including many children. And in our own hemisphere, General Laura Richardson, who served until about a year ago as the commander of Southcom, increasingly was responding to climate-driven insecurities across the region, combined with increased Chinese investment and development and other wildlife trafficking, human trafficking, narco trafficking, and else in that region. The International Military Council on Climate and Security, which I co-founded with General Tom Mittendorp over 5 years ago, is a group of military and national security professionals focused on addressing the national security risks of climate change, and that has led in part to NATO standing up its first center of excellence on climate and security in the last year. Let me say a little bit about military bases here at home. because we have, of course, you know, here on the coast, UCU experience changing sea level rise here in Maine and down in Norfolk, Virginia. It's an area in Tidewater that's very subject to sea level rise, storm surge, and natural subsidence of the land. And Admiral Ann Phillips was the commander of Expeditionary Strike Group 2 in Norfolk during Superstorm Sandy in 2012, and actually sent ships from Norfolk to New York to relieve the Coast Guard that got knocked out in Sandy Hook in the storm. And so Secretary of Defense at the time, Leon Panetta, said, "We are using our military in a war against nature herself." And Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida was heavily damaged by Hurricane Michael. The roofs were ripped off the hangars of the F-35 and has been rebuilt as the climate resilient base of the future. Our troops also face increasing heat peril when they deploy. They're subject to heat stress, and the heat index, of course, is rising for everyone around the world, and that particularly affects our military as they deploy. When we think about energy use in the military, we think most of it is in what we call operational energy. Fighters and bombers, the Air Force uses most of it, and about a third of it is for our military bases. And the focus has been, even throughout this changing prioritization on climate change, the focus has been for the last decade to have less fuel and more fight. In other words, we've got to get our forces wherever they need to be, whether it's in the Gulf, whether it's in the Pacific, and they have to be ready to perform their military mission. They can't be tethered to long logistic supply lines of liquid fuels. We experienced the hard way in Iraq and Afghanistan that we were losing soldiers and Marines who were trucking fuel to the front to deadly attacks by improvised explosive devices. And so for a decade or more now, there's been innovation in military energy, both in batteries, in hybrid electric vehicles, in new designs, and that have really revolutionized and have become an incubator for energy innovation throughout the military. Okay, so just to close out on how do I think about climate-proofing our security in this era, we are on the cusp of a lot of improved predictive capabilities if we don't cut off our knees to spite our face by dismantling the capabilities we have today in NOAA for weather prediction, because there's a lot that's happening in AI that will enable us to improve our forecasting. And forecasting is good not only for the military, but for planning your event next week, and you want to know, is it going to rain or not? I've got a wedding happening at my family wedding this week, and every day I'm looking at, okay, is it going to rain when I have that brunch? And do I really know how accurate that forecast is going to be until a few days out? But we're on the cusp of much improved shorter-term weather, what we call near-term weather prediction. And then we have to adapt, avoid the unavoidable impacts of climate change, move to a net zero military ultimately, and reimagine our global military alliances. We see a growing military response to climate hazards around the world. The U.S. deployed nearly 200 times in 12 countries in the last 2.5 years for climate hazards. And this is a little bit about NATO's new Center on Climate and Security. It's based in Montreal, not too far from here, and it's focused on addressing how to adapt to the core missions of defense and deterrence through becoming more resilient. And just to sort of connect and end on your kind of soft power theme that you're going into, I have throughout my career tried to use the capabilities and the talent and the leadership resident within our armed forces, not only to defend America and keep us safe at home from armed conflict, but to use those strengths and capabilities we have to be a force for good and engagement through those other forms of engagement to build peace, whether it's through environmental peace building or other types of peace building. And so I think that I hope that you will carry that, some of that spirit with you. And I'm very happy to have had this opportunity to share these thoughts with you today. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Obviously, a lot of work has gone into this already, but there's a whole lot of work still to be done. While they're collecting questions, I usually take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. As you were talking, I was thinking about, you mentioned that the Russians had done had some military facilities in the Arctic or close up there. How militarized is the Arctic now? And do you foresee that that's going to increase over time, that the conflicts are going to increase as the waterways open up more and the resources are become more available?
Well, let me distinguish between having military capability and whether or not that actually leads to armed conflict, because in many cases, having the right kind of military capability can deter conflict. So it is, for the most part, true that at the end of the Cold War, both the U.S. and the Russians let lapse some of their military facilities. We pulled out of a base in Iceland, and we downgraded some of our capabilities in Greenland, and the Russians were not able to maintain some of their military facilities. But over the last decade, almost 12 to 15 years now, especially under Putin, they have upgraded and modernized many military facilities along the Arctic, increased their icebreaking capability. The Russians have about 40 icebreakers. They have a floating nuclear power plant. They see this, I think, first and foremost for Putin. The Arctic has long been a key identity for the Russians in a way. Alaska is not a key. We don't. If you're in Washington, or maybe it's different here in Maine now, but most parts of the U.S. you go to, people don't say, "Oh, we're an Arctic nation." Oh yeah, we know Alaska, but in Russia, it's really different. 20% of the GDP is based on activities in the Russian Arctic, so it has long been a source of economic and industrial strength. And it holds a special place, I think, in the Russian identity. So Russia has modernized its military facilities. It's nuclearized a lot of capabilities. I said there's nuclear icebreakers. Of course, there's long been nuclear submarines, floating nuclear power plants, many more. The U.S. in recent years has also significantly upgraded its military capabilities in the Arctic, mostly to deter Russian, Chinese, North Korean, or other nuclear missile threats, or other missile threats. So, and that's by having bases in Alaska and space-based capability. We have a network, a ring across the Arctic with our allies and partners, including Canada, Greenland, and the Nordics. So we are well able to defend against space-based and air-based missile threats. We, of course, have our submarine, the most secure leg of our triad. We watch closely how changing ocean circulation conditions and changing ocean conditions affect the Russians' ability to exit the all-important Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, which is where they take their submarines from the Northern Fleet, the fabled Northern Fleet on the Kola Peninsula, the one that had the sunken submarines back in the 90s that the Norwegians were worried about. But that is also their major bastion for their nuclear submarines, and they exit from there down through something called the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. And their ability to be undetected changes as the ocean changes, something that's important for us, very important for us to understand. And so that is also a concern. Now, whether that's going to lead to armed conflict, I would say when I talk about what keeps me up at night in the Arctic today, it is more likely to be an accident. An accident such as, we did a scenario exercise within parts of the U.S. government a few years ago looking at an incident in the Bering Strait between Alaska and Russia, where Russian icebreaker is escorting a Chinese liquid nuclear fuel vessel, and there's an accident, and it's only 30 miles off the coast, but it's in international waters, and what happens is there a hazardous release, are there fatalities, a search and rescue commission, rescue mission, who responds? So I think accidents from collisions or tourist accident, as you have increasing vessels up there, is of concern, or an oil spill. We still don't really understand well how to clean up a massive oil spill in the Arctic. You think back to the Exxon Valdez spill, that wasn't even in the Arctic. And we haven't yet had a really significant spill there. So is there more tension? Yes, there is more tension. And that's how I think about the current situation.
Thank you. There's a question about the extent to which the military community is still willing to accept the reality of global warming. Are they, and are they more willing than the current administration to accept the realities?
The military, like science and engineering community, is trained to make their decisions based on the best available evidence. And there's always an assumption of risk. You know, in any decision you make to deploy a force, you always risk that you might lose some troops, there might be a fatality. But you try to limit that risk. And so from time immemorial, well, understanding the weather has been important to any military operation. Think back to D-Day and the decision General Eisenhower made what day to actually launch that massive invasion was determined in large measure by the weather forecast. Right? And in that era, the weather forecast was reliable only 2 to 3 days out. Today we get 3 to 5 days of reliable weather forecasting. And in the future we'll get even more. So the military understands the risks. Now, in the current political circumstances we find ourselves in, they are attuned to how to talk about it. So they understand that sometimes instead of saying climate, you might say extreme conditions. In fact, there is a very important tool that was the Army Corps of Engineers developed. The work was led by a very brilliant woman who actually lives in Hanover, New Hampshire, works for the Army Corps of Engineers. And during the first Trump administration, she led an effort to develop something called the Defense Climate Assessment Tool, DCAT, Defense Climate Assessment Tool. It's a screening level tool for military infrastructure, military bases that gives you a sense of what are your risks from fire, from floods, from heat, from wind. And it was adopted even during the Trump administration. It was adopted from the Army Corps to the full Army, then to the entire Department of Defense. And then in the last administration, the Biden administration, it was even shared with some of our allies and partners to enable them to assess the climate risks to their military bases. Now, what's happening to that tool today? Well, it is now called the Defense Extreme Conditions Assessment Tool. DCAT. Still goes by DCAT. It's just D-E-C-A-T. Defense Extreme Conditions Assessment. But don't tell anybody I told you that. No. Okay. No. I mean, these things are important because we still have to operate. And, you know, as we talked about Hurricane Michael heavily damaging Tinsel Air Force Base in Florida, where we have the F-35, we have to be resilient. We have to have hangars today that can withstand, instead of 100 mile per hour winds, which is what they were originally designed for, about that, now they have to be able to withstand 140 mile per hour winds. So the design specifications, the building codes for our military infrastructure has to be resilient and recognize the changing conditions under which we operate.
I've got several questions here about the effect of climate on migration and what the human migration. You talked about the fish migrating north, but there's also humans migrating as well. And one question is mass migration due to climate change an issue yet, or is it something still on the horizon we have to worry about more in the future?
Well, it's climate-driven migration is always connected to other factors, right? If you have enough air conditioning and you have a very good economy, if you live in UAE, you can withstand a lot of heat, right? If you can have resilient infrastructure, resilient society. But if you're in parts of India or if you're in parts of Latin America where your crops are failing because of persistent and unpredictable heat, droughts, extreme, more intense hurricanes that wipe out what you thought you were going to plant, and your livelihoods are not secure, and then your family becomes subject to traffickers and human traffickers and other traffickers, you know, then people are on the move. So it's become more of a factor. It's never the only factor. But it is increasingly a factor in driving people to seek safety and security elsewhere around the world, from Latin America and other parts of South America towards our own, into Mexico, towards our own borders. You know the crisis we have. From parts of Africa into Europe, you've read about that, they've experienced, and also across parts of Asia, and certainly, from the Pacific Island nations, specifically into Australia and New Zealand and some other countries with more capacity.
Your discussion here was about the mitigating effects. If you have enough air conditioning, people don't move, et cetera. But is climate change, which is ongoing and accelerating, does humanity actually have a chance to mitigate it in the long term? Or have we already reached that point of no return?
Well, if we have, none of us will be here to know that. probably our kids or grandkids won't either. And I don't think so. I mean, we are transitioning our planet to a new Earth system in many ways. And it's not that humans aren't able to adapt. Species will certainly adapt. Other species will adapt. And I think humans can figure out how to adapt. It may well mean that, in coming decades, there are coastal areas that are less inhabited and shouldn't be rebuilt after the storm, some flooding in there. And other areas will be more highly developed. So I think that resilience is possible if we are clear-eyed about it and we assess the cost. Of course, those with more means are more readily able to make that investment and then to have those opportunities. The question is when, how do we ensure that enough people have those opportunities?
And your comments on nuclear waste seem to have generated a tremendous number of questions.
People want to know. I see a lot of former nukes in there.
Since nuclear power is returning, is power plant waste going to be an issue? And how does the waste disposal impact nuclear energy development? Two sides of the same coin.
Okay. One on the last piece last question, I just want to observe that, we often talk about trying to lift people around the world out of energy poverty, right? Parts of Africa or Asia that don't have regular electricity. And we see that, people should be able to not just charge their phones, but have lights and running water and everything. But we also at some point are going to have to address whether people should be lifted out of climate poverty. Because if you don't have here maybe it's better. In Maine, you can certainly adapt. If winters get warmer, maybe that's better for some people. But if people lose their fishing grounds or opportunities, that changes. Okay, to nuclear. We have failed as a nation to address long-term repository for high-level waste. Yucca Mountain never came to pass. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was in the Pentagon, at one point, I was the Secretary of Energy at the time, Bill Richardson, asked me to come over and meet with him. And I was very pregnant at the time, I think with my second child. It was maybe 1998, 99. And I come waddling into his office, and he says, "Sherry, sit down." And okay, I said, "Mr. Secretary, nice to see you." And he says, "Sherry, I have a job for you." I said, "Oh, what's that?" He said, "I'd like you to be the civilian radioactive waste negotiator." That's the Yucca Mountain high-level waste repository job. And he said, he actually used another word I won't use here. "It's a bad job. And I need a woman to do it." And I was like, "Mr. Secretary, I don't really look like I'm in any condition to actually take that job." And I didn't. But so we have not solved as a nation high-level waste. We have a transuranic waste repository called WIP, Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. It is in southern New Mexico, in Carlsbad, New Mexico. It holds only defense transuranic waste. Could it be expanded? Unclear. Would there be political support? Unclear. How long will, now it is true that we have it, we still have capacity at our spent fuel pools where we store nuclear waste from our existing 90 some odd nuclear reactors today. And we are also developing more advanced types of fuel that arguably in the future will produce much less waste. So we won't necessarily have going forward with advanced reactors and new fuel types the same kind of very large spent fuel rods that we store in these ponds now. We will have something smaller. Will it still ultimately need to be stored? Yes. Will that be a challenge we need? There are some states have offered the opportunity. I think, I can't remember now whether it's parts of Texas or Wyoming, Utah have offered to be the home for a waste repository. So under the right set of conditions, I think that is will be possible in the future.
And there's a couple of questions specifically on something you commented on before, which was U.S.-Russian cooperation on waste. First one is, I've read that Novaya Zemlya, where the Soviet Union tested its nuclear weapons, the test sites are beginning to leak radiation. A, have you looked into this? And the more general question is, you interacted in the 1990s with the Russian military on nuclear pollution. Is that kind of interaction still possible at all in today's environment, given that Novaya Zemlya may be leaking radiation and it may be of concern?
The short answer is no. There is just not that engagement anymore with the Russian military or with Russian academics. That's not to say it couldn't happen. You know, at some point, will there be some kind of deal on Ukraine, whatever shape that takes? I don't, you know, it's hard to know right now. We seem to be back in the place where we were in the last administration at the moment, but you know, when and if, I mean, I don't think that war will last forever. And when and if there is that conflict comes to an end, will Russia at some point be readmitted to places like the Arctic Council, which is a place where you would have the ability to engage scientists on things like permafrost thaw and collapse or other contaminants in the Russian Arctic?
And finally, on the same theme, the Russian Maine Maritime Academy has restarted its nuclear engineering minor. Do you think we should be restarting nuclear development of nuclear and increasing nuclear, or is it your personal view that we should kind of set that aside and go down other energy routes?
Oh, no, absolutely. We need the next generation of nuclear and nuclear energy, and we need it now. It's safer, more reliable. We cannot achieve reliable baseload, carbon-free power without reinvigorating American leadership in nuclear energy. We still get a lot of our electricity from nuclear energy, and we're keeping some plants open. You know, if we don't stay, the U.S. Really stopped exporting a lot of nuclear technology to other countries until the last 5 years or so, and that has allowed China and Russia to become the major suppliers of new nuclear energy around the world. To me, that's way more dangerous. I don't want to have more Chinese reactors in Pakistan, for example, a nuclear-armed country. I would much rather have the U.S. be the primary nuclear energy supplier. That's part of our deal under the Abraham Accords with the Saudis now to enable them to develop their nuclear energy industry. And it's much better for American industry. We have safer, we have just a really enormous record of safety. Despite what I told you about my experiences with the safety lapses in the 90s, you know, our civilian nuclear power industry and our naval reactors have, particularly naval reactors, have operated with an impeccable safety record for decades. And here in Maine, you've been very much a part of that. And so I think that that is a strength that America has. We need to retain, we need to build, and we need to develop that. And one of the, you know, that is an area today of bipartisan support. And so I think we will see more development of civilian nuclear power capabilities in the United States.
Well, I think we have time for one more question, and this is, again, a one that several people touched upon. Someone want to know how much of your work and accomplishments have survived during these first few months of the administration? And related, is there anyone left at State or Pentagon who is an expert in the Arctic and climate? We hear a lot in the news, but it's nice to get some insider's information.
Right. Well, anyone who's in the Pentagon today, an expert in, well, people, there are people. They're not giving public talks right now. Okay. And I, and nor should they. I mean, they should be doing their job. And many of them are doing their job. There are many dedicated civil servants. Too many have lost their jobs, way too many. It's so tragic. It's tragic for the individuals and families affected. It's tragic because we're losing a whole generation of talent that will be hard to rebuild. But it, particularly in defense maybe than in other areas, there are people still working. Energy gets a lot of attention there. That's sort of an adjacent area to some of what we're talking about, and certainly understanding global security risks, including in a changing Arctic. So Arctic, yes, I would say there still is focus on that region, and there are still some very good people in service. Well, not as many as we need.
I wish we had time for more, but and I apologize to people if we didn't get to your question, but we want to thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.